Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson. And of course, if it's Friday, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of The Quam Report, the voice of Texas, the dean of the Austin Press Corps. And like me, he hasn't been sleeping either, given the craziness, the cacophony of news and information and misinformation. I am telling you, Scott, I actually begin to understand why people run away from the news, because the instability it's creating in my life is making me difficult to even begin to figure out how to process. And I don't know how people are doing it.
Well, you know, it's not necessarily that the world is any more crazy than it was decades ago, but you do see every second of the crazy all day long, right?
Thank
on 24-hour news channels.
Instant gratification.
Online, you see it on social media.
Right.
Two things can happen at once, of course, and more things than that can happen at once. Certain things can be spiraling downward, and we get to watch all of it. I'm like you. I probably felt jet lags the other day, just like you did, watching the news all night. I think I went to sleep the night of the retaliation, supposed retaliation. I think I went to sleep around 5 a.m. Texas time.
No.
Around 7, something like that, went right back to work, watching all this stuff unfold and trying to, you know, make any kind of sense out of it. And you look around and you say, okay, what's going on here? You have Mike Lee, who's a senator from Utah, staunch conservative / libertarian, and one of the best buddies of the junior senator from Texas, Ted Cruz. They could not be in more different positions about this. You saw the administration gave a briefing to all 100 senators, and even some Republicans, including Lee, including Rand Paul, the outliers. They come out and they said what? That this was the most disrespectful and worst briefing that any administration has ever provided the U.S. Senate about anything, especially on a military deal. If you watched Mike Lee, it looked like his head was going to explode.
Yeah, exactly.
Arnie,
exactly.
I looked at it and he's almost shouting, and he's telling the news media that this is a terrible explanation from the administration about their justification for all of this, because he said they really didn't have one. They basically told them what they had already read in the newspapers. They didn't really allow the senators to ask any questions. They did about 75 minutes with the senators, which I know that you know that not allowing senators to ask questions is not wise. They have lots of questions. They wanted, about Republicans and Democrats, by the way, they wanted to know specifics about what had gone down here with this assassination, this killing of Soleimani. You have Iran supposedly hitting us, hitting our bases that house U.S. troops with missiles. And people, of course, start asking, is this like the Gulf of Tonkin? Are we going straight into another war here being provoked in a situation that may not be on the up and up? What did Mike Lee say about the question about whether this should be authorized by Congress if it's going to happen?
They
ought to have to come ask, right? The War Powers Resolution to go after, what was the, let's ask this, Arnie, as I think it through here as we talk about it. What was the reason that the United States Congress passed the most recent military authorization of force?
9/11.
It was to go after who? The Taliban.
Yep.
And in the meantime,
9/11.
Our focus has also shifted to a different terrorist organization, ISIS. Mm-hmm. What's happening in this situation? Forces are standing down from dealing with ISIS, right?
Yeah.
While we deal with this. So I don't know how this could be the United States taking its eye off the ball more, but what is our senator doing? Senator Ted Cruz, it was reported, was putting together a resolution, supporting the killing of Soleimani and daring Democrats, like it's all a game, daring Democrats to oppose it from Fox News Channel. An aide to Cruz said the resolution was structured and worded the same way as a 2011 resolution that commended the Obama administration for killing Osama bin Laden, and that received unanimous support in the Senate. The question isn't whether you kill a bad guy because they're a bad guy, Arnie. The world is filled with bad guys, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, why do we kill certain bad guys?
And the timing of when we kill certain bad guys.
You kill them.
Yep.
And then are you ready for what happens next? And everything. When I first was watching this, and I think we talked about it a little bit previously, when I first was watching this unfold, I thought it was maybe wrong for people to specifically ask the question, is this president ready for this? I think the question would be, is any president ready for what comes?
What happens
after this? Don't make it partisan. Don't make it about Trump. Are we ready for what happens after this happens? And I kind of think about it, when it comes to foreign affairs, I think about it like a game of pool, right? I mean, you might sink a ball in the corner pocket, but where did all the other balls go in the meantime? And I don't think anybody has their eye on the other balls. I think they're still moving, and we don't know what's going to happen next, Arnie.
Let me just show you how off the charts Lindsey Graham has become. I mean, I think he's lost his mind. Listen to this one. Lindsey Graham compares Trump's Iran remarks to Reagan's tear down this wall address.
You think that's a stretch?
Let me remind everyone a little bit about why the senator from Utah was so apoplectic. And first of all, I think he was basically being told, you're supposed to not question what the administration has done,
that
you are on our chain and our leash. We're going to pull the leash. We're going to let go of the leash, but understand we control the leash. So that clearly means that how they were being talked down to was they didn't respect the idea of the different branches of government, and that was the initial intent, especially because Congress was supposed to have the War Powers Act. Number one, that was the idea of being talked down to. What I also think is interesting is what people need to know is every U.S. senator thinks they should be president.
Of course.
So the level of ego.
They all that look is, in the mirror in the morning.
Exactly. So to be treated like children, to be told how to behave, to be told not to question when
don't
in fact the Constitution
–
and not to debate it because somehow that's not within their purview. It was just so incredible. But then you read Lindsey Graham's comments about what he said. Tear down this wall. That's the equivalency with Ronald Reagan. There's nothing rational anymore. There's nothing real anymore. I don't know how Republicans are processing. And as a result, because I don't know how Republicans are processing, let's be honest here, Scott. How do you run against this insanity? No, I'm being very honest here. How do you actually organize a campaign when facts have no meaning, when everyone is basically saying the sky is purple when it's actually blue? I'm frightened. I'm so frightened because I don't know how to deal with this because it's so unreal.
In a situation where it's so chaotic, I mean, if you just kind of step back and look at it objectively as far as what's going to happen on the battlefield of politics.
The battlefield of politics is a battlefield.
If you look at it that way, it has to advantage the person who's unmoored from facts.
Yes, of course.
Right. If everything's chaotic,
yes.
The person who will just say and do anything has the advantage. Where you know, and that, by the way, there are good, solid people who run campaigns that I know who are Republicans and Democrats, and will tell you privately that it is very difficult to run against folks who are completely, just divorced from reality in the way that they and have no obligation to the truth. There are some campaigns, you can doubt it if you like, Arnie, but there are some campaigns where they don't do that. They'll tell you, look, we'll do a lot of things, we'll stretch things, we'll play hard, we know it's not beanbag, but we won't just make things up. And then you'll watch the other campaign and go, well, wow, that other campaign does not have any problem with just making things up. And so when you look at what's unfolding now nationally, I feel it's uncharted territory, Arnie.
Well, I'm going to be discussing this. We tape everyone Thursday morning, our Friday show, so let me just sort of lay this foundation down. But this afternoon, we're going to be talking with Stefan Schmidt from Iowa and also Bill Curry from Connecticut. And what I think is so fascinating, as we are feeling so unmoored, and as the Democrats are trying to figure out how to respond, and obviously the next debate is going to be focusing on foreign policy. It's going to be very, very interesting. Because in some ways it is. It's going to go back to, guess what? How did you vote on the Iraq War?
Yep.
That's going to be the essence of the conversation.
Sure.
I saw a poll coming out, Scott, that Mayor Bloomberg is beating Donald Trump in Michigan. And it turned out that Bernie, Biden, and Bloomberg are all beating him. Now, Bloomberg is the other interesting wild card because he doesn't have to respond on a debate stage. He doesn't have a vote about the war in Iraq. He has no history the way Bernie does and Biden does. He can sort of land and release whenever he wants. He's going to be in the Super Bowl. It's going to be so interesting to see how he plays it out because as we have this guy who doesn't rely on facts, i.e. Donald Trump, and as we have a group group of candidates who are trying to do the normal primary, we have this gazillionaire who's able to play outside both arenas. Oh, my God, it's so interesting.
Very interesting, and you have to wonder if Bloomberg is also trying to clear the field of the candidates who, you know, he's not, sympathetic to, and not necessarily with the goal of, you know, making himself be the victor for the nomination, be the victor of the White House. You know, that's one of the things that he can afford to accomplish because,
right.
you know, he's writing big checks and he's
right.
able to spend, put resources into the field and spend money
endless
in ways these other candidates are not able to, right?
Right?
They're having to focus on the early states, on Iowa, on New Hampshire, on South Carolina, mm-hmm. Nevada, et cetera. And Bloomberg's already here in Texas, block walking.
That's why I wanted you to talk about that.
A candidate in the Houston suburbs and spending at least $4 million so far just in the Houston market alone.
Wow. I think people need to really comprehend what Bloomberg has the capacity to do. Please understand, even if Bernie and Elizabeth aren't doing those big, you know, high donor fundraisers, they still have to spend money to raise money. They still have to spend money. The beauty of Bloomberg is he doesn't have to spend a dime in order to raise money. All he has to do is take out his pen and write a check. I mean, that's all he has to do. It's the ink in the pen that says Mike. I mean, that's the cost of what it is for him. Plus, he can target. I mean, the idea that he was walking in Texas should tell you about the visibility. The fact that he's buying ads in Texas. I mean, the candidates that are running for office right now aren't even focusing on Texas for the most part, in part because they still have to convince South Carolina, Nevada, Iowa, and New Hampshire. And he's completely just said, I'm going to ignore those states because I'm going to where actually the votes are.
Going where the votes are, and it sort of has the ability, because of the resources, able to remake the primary a little bit. It might be interesting, to note that if he had been doing this earlier on, the complaints of Julian Castro and others, about the unfairness, if you will, of the nominating process,
right.
it might have undercut those arguments some, because there would be different arguments being made in states that are not the ones that Castro and others were complaining
so
about.
So let's go to Castro really quickly, because
yes.
Castro decided to endorse Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of people at first were somewhat surprised by this, but I have to share a really interesting statistic I learned yesterday. So I interviewed this woman from Vox.com, and they were talking about how women donate to campaigns. Mm-hmm. And one thing she said was, women are unlike men. They donate to many campaigns. They kind of look around and say, oh, I like these four. I'm going to send them all a little check, okay? Men, for whatever reason, have this machismo thing. Oh, I like this guy. I'm going with him. Right, from the very beginning. So they have a different investment pattern. But guess which candidate received more money proportionally from women than any of the candidates running? Julian Castro.
That'd be Castro. Uh-huh.
I thought that was absolutely fascinating. Not only did we see the biggest percentage of money coming in from him, and I think in an interesting way, in part because of his position on immigration, because we've talked about separating families at the border, because we've talked about putting kids at the cage, the idea that kind of resonated, especially with suburban women. Like, oh my God, how can we have this kind of inhumanity? And to a large extent, the person that most personified speaking out against this in such a forceful way was Julian.
Absolutely, and I think he's got the ability to bring people into the fold for somebody like Warren in a way that maybe he wasn't even able to do for his own campaign because of the way that the nominating process is structured.
Yes.
He can be in places like Nevada, in Texas,
yep.
et cetera, talking to Hispanic voters, talking to those female voters, talking to voters who care about certain issues, that some of the Democrats were sort of reluctant to even discuss on the campaign trail.
Exactly.
And he's able to do that. And also, with Castro, it's very interesting, Arnie, that he has been so willing, because this was not the case before with him or his brother, to be so aggressive and sort of be an attack dog. That was not what we saw from Castro previously. But
yeah,
one of the problems that the Castros have had with the media previously is so many questions that they would face about their sort of reluctance to really get in there and be aggressive when it mm-hmm. came to any sort of debate,
mm-hmm.
when it came to anything. They were always sort of criticized as cautious,
mm-hmm.
if you will, in
yes.
the way that they would make their moves.
Which is why I was so surprised at their behavior on the campaign trail, because
yes.
it was so unlike how you described them.
That is not at all the Castros that And by the way, it was both of them.
Yeah.
Joaquin Castro as a congressman with a very aggressive role in the impeachment hearings,
yeah.
Right? And at the same time, his brother Julian really taking on not only Biden, but sort of one of his legacy moves within the campaign will be that he's the guy who kneecapped Beto O'Rourke, his fellow Texan, in their very first debate and really sort of put him off kilter.
Well, let me explain to you a little bit.
So with the Castros, by the way, I saw where Warren had said one of the interviews that Castro, this is not just a one-off, like he's endorsing and then moving on, that he wants to be very involved.
Active.
In this campaign, so watch him moving forward.
Well, let me just say something else, and I'm gonna explain a little bit of the Castro brothers and how they seem to have changed from being more sort of not aggressive to taking on a much more aggressive position. Let's also look at what's happening in Texas. You've been teaching me over and over again. Not only is there a changing demographic, there is the potential for Texas to go purple. I mean, blue would be insane, but it could happen in 2020. So what they are also seeing is that the foundations of politics is shifting in Texas. As it shifts, as it moves more Democratic, more blue, it also liberates them to be able to articulate a much more progressive or outspoken position, because before they had to sort of cover their you-know-what. Now they are feeling more liberated. I'll give you a perfect example of that. I'm being interviewed today by the Japanese media, and one of the conversations is, explain Bernie Sanders. Let me explain Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders comes from a state the size of a suburb. Bernie Sanders comes from a state that's more like Sweden than it is like the United States.
Urban Boston.
Exactly. So he's never had to control what he said. He's never had to limit what he said. He could be as liberal or socialist or progressive, and he would get reelected. So what Bernie is liberated to do, you are now beginning to see what's happening with the Castro brothers, where 6 years ago, this would not be possible. But in today's Texas, it is becoming more possible. That's really why you're seeing these candidates becoming a little more full-throated on some of the positions that before seemed so much more muted.
To underscore the point, in 2014, this would be two off-year elections ago,
right.
At this point. In 2014, Republicans just destroyed Democrats in Texas. John Cornyn beat his Democratic opponent, going back to that time, mm-hmm. Years ago, by 26 points. In 2014, other Republican candidates on the ballot, including Governor Abbott, the Lieutenant Governor, the Comptroller, et cetera, they beat their Democratic opponents by about 21 points.
Oh, my God.
Fast forward 4 years later, and you have Beto O'Rourke coming within 3 points of
right.
Ted Cruz,
right.
And that tracked across the ballot, with a down ballot, with other races for other offices. In fact, and this was before the elimination of straight ticket voting in Texas, which
yep.
is the law now that
right.
it is 2020. We don't have straight ticket voting anymore. And so it'll be very interesting to see what happens with that. That's one of my key things to watch
right.
This
the
year
jump
in Texas.
Ball.
But even before that was done away with, in 2018, there were 500,000 people in Texas who voted for Beto O'Rourke and then crossed over and voted for Greg Abbott and other Republicans. What will those people do
exactly.
in 2020? I don't know the answer. But stay tuned.
Voters matter. This, you know what this is? This is about
sure.
I always personalize these things because I've had a little bit of political experience. I lost my race for governor in 1992. Despite losing the race by what looked like a large margin, and we'll talk about that later, I got more votes than any Democrat in history in 1992. Now, what did that mean? I still lost. But we swept in so many different folks into the New Hampshire legislature that despite the fact that the Republicans still controlled the legislature, it was one of the most progressive New Hampshire legislators we'd ever had because I had skirt tails. That's exactly what happened. And what you are seeing happening in Texas is a result of what you saw because of what Beto did against Ted Cruz. So now take me into what's going on in 2020, because obviously there are a couple things that are going to be impacting the 2020 politics. And that is, what's happening with Dennis Bonin? I'm trying to figure out. I thought he's off the political scene. Isn't he not running again? What is changing as we look at both the Republicans controlling the House and who wants to run for Speaker? And is it assumed that it will be a Republican?
I have to tell you that Republican Texas House members are very nervous going into 2020 that they're going to lose the majority.
Yes.
By 2021, there will be a Democratic Speaker. And by the way, it was pointed out at QuorumReport.com by my publisher, Harvey Kronberg, this week, that you do have the potential for the first time in modern history to have back-to-back-to-back three-time wide-open speakers races in one session after another. Bonin was elected in the last session. You could have a Democrat elected in the session coming up in 2021. And after that, there is a possibility, because of all this chaos, Arnie, that Republicans take the majority back, even if it's a slim majority, by the very next session. And then you have another Republican speaker by then. So there's a lot of uncertainty. Nobody knows exactly what's going to happen, and Republicans are nervous about this. I heard about some infighting this week, sort of under the radar, with Texas House Republicans talking to each other mm-hmm. about whether all of the chairmen who were appointed by Speaker Bonin ought to resign because their appointments are tainted by the scandal. Just to remind people, remember what happened. He was caught on tape plotting against members of his own party. He basically gave up some sacrificial lambs to some of these third-party right-wing enforcement groups. This was caught on tape. He said, look, but please don't spend a lot of money on Republican primaries against my team. If you do need to take out some people in primaries, here's 10 Republicans who are okay to do so. But wait till you hear this statement from Bonin.
Okay, I can't wait.
He was accused in the pages of Quorum Report by me mm-hmm. of retaliating against Republican members of the House who had withdrawn their support amid this scandal. There were two examples of this. One is a guy named Lyle Larson, who's a Republican state representative from San Antonio. Larson has been an expert in the House on water issues, and water infrastructure is critical in Texas, Arnie. Mm-hmm. And even Republicans and Democrats alike, I should say, respect Representative Larson for his his expertise in dealing with water issues. Well, he was one of the Republicans who said he could no longer support Bonin as Speaker. Mm-hmm. And guess what? Bonin is still there. He said he was going to retire, mm-hmm. But that's not until next year. He busted him from a committee that deals with water. He took him off of it. And then another one of the Republican chairmen who displeased Bonin told him he couldn't support him anymore. Was taken off a very important committee, a commission actually called the Sunset Commission, which deals with overseeing state agencies. Is a short version of that. Basically, two Republicans who, it appears to everybody, were punished by Bonin because they withdrew their support from this guy, who again was plotting against members of his own party, was caught on tape saying that one female member of the House was vile, that one Democratic member from Houston must be a closeted gay man. Those were some of the comments on that tape. Listen to what Bonin said to the Dallas Morning News this week.
Okay.
Because some people are saying, he's retaliating against these members, and he's putting other members in their place who are his buddies. He said, quote, "I think it's sad when members denigrate each other. The success they've had because they didn't get what they wanted. It's important that the members who got such significant efforts over the finish line be put in a position to see them through," unquote. This is sort of a lack of self-awareness, Arnie,
yeah.
I think is the way people are looking at this.
Well, Donald Trump has promoted
that
concept.
And let me tell you, people, the voters don't know still. I mean, if you look at the polling, I've looked at internal polling, mm-hmm. public polling, the voters don't know that much about the scandal with Bonin.
Mm-hmm.
But I can tell you that it has Republicans nervous because guess what? Behind the scenes, they're still fighting with each other about this sort of stuff. Instead of uniting around a common message to try to preserve their majority, which is absolutely in danger.
So you know who can deliver the message about what happened with Speaker Bonin? Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg can just, I mean, if he knows how important Texas is, if he's walking the blocks in Houston or wherever he's walking, if he's able to do this, he could, I mean, again, this guy doesn't have to play by any set of rules because one, he's got too much money, and two, because what he really wants to do is sort of upset the apple cart and begin to shift voters away from Republicans. This would be a perfect opportunity to explain the chaos within the Republican Party, what Bonin did, and again, when you're beginning to have people looking for the first time, because it's not going to be straight ticketed voting. It's going to be fascinating to watch how this thing plays out. That's all I have to say. Really quickly before I let you go, though, Scott, you mentioned that a Democratic candidate for the United States Senate from Texas is forced to apologize after repeatedly saying she is more Mexican than other Mexicans. How is that possible?
I am very used to seeing most of the stupidity in primaries play out in Republican primaries in Texas. This is particularly tone deaf. Christina Sinzun Ramirez is a workers' rights advocate from Austin. She lives in Austin. And had said at a Dallas event that her name, Sinzun, is, quote, more Mexican than any Garcia or Lopez, unquote. It sounded like maybe a one-off sort of strange thing to say.
Yes.
There was immediate backlash from Latinos, from Hispanics, who said, what do you mean you're more Hispanic or more Mexican than I am? This did not go over very well. She had to apologize for that. But Arnie, I was told that this is something that she was saying at events all over the place. It's a standard line.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so just bizarre. I don't know that it's a death blow to her campaign or anything like that, but we're just getting going. Of course, the primary is coming up on March 3rd. There are about almost a dozen Democrats who are running for the chance to take on Senator Cornyn in the fall. And, of course, because there's that many candidates, it will go to a runoff, which, of course, will become unnecessarily nasty, I'm sure.
All right, before I let you go, just because she was more Mexican than other Mexicans, I just want to let you know that I was born in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, where there are more Norwegians than in Oslo, Norway. I'm more Norwegian than the Norwegians. So on that note, thank God, this is insane. Thank you so much, Scott Braddock, for joining us. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He's also known as the Voice of Texas and the Dean of the Austin Press Corps. If it's Friday, it must be Scott. All right, stick around, everyone. Kevin Landrigan, the Dean of the New Hampshire Press Corps, will be joining us to talk about politics just both nationally as well as locally. Stick around. We'll be right back.
What goes in must come out on this current cast.
There are plenty of communities that get their water from Lake Michigan, and there's plenty of communities that their wastewater enters Lake Michigan. So it's clearly connected.
That's Sean McElmurray of Wayne State University. He says wastewater includes pollutants such as traces of prescription drugs that people have taken or disposed of. Most wastewater treatment and water purification plants do not have the capacity to remove all of these chemicals, and upgrades would be costly. Since prescription pollutants are making their way into our drinking water, there's widespread agreement that research needs to be done to learn exactly what impact these drugs have on our health and the environment. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cordell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
I'm a desperate man. Send lawyers, guns, and money. The shit has hit the fan. Oh, send lawyers, guns, and money. Guns and money. Send lawyers, guns and money. Hey! Send lawyers, guns and money. Oh!
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Dave Scott. So we just hung out with Scott Braddock, the editor of the Quorum Report, known as the voice of Texas. Well, I think Kevin Landrigan could be called the voice of New Hampshire. He is also the dean of the New Hampshire Press Corps. Sadly, you know what I was thinking about this, Kevin? You write for the union leader now. But I was looking at bringing in reporters to talk to different students that are coming through my house. I offered it to you. You may not be able to do this. But as I realized, 4 years ago, I had about maybe 10 or 12 more people who cover New Hampshire and presidential politics that I could have called on. Today, that list has shrunk to about 5 or 6.
Yeah,
that's just in 4 years. And it's like I feel like I'm letting these students down. But then I realize, look at how my state has been let down by the fact that these reporters don't exist anymore. And when we have a house of 400 members with, you know, thousands of bills that are coming through, when you realize that we cover presidential politics and we have, you know, at this point, still, I don't know how many are still left in the race, maybe 14. How do you thread the needle, cover local issues, state issues, and now national issues? Because in a lot of ways, we are sort of at the center of the storm. It's really amazing.
Yeah, so, we definitely are. And that's a lot of plates to juggle, and maybe a couple hit the floor because we missed them. That's more likely to happen now than, as you point out, than 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And that's not a happy commentary on the state of the media.
And to be honest with you, so I've got people coming in from the Midwest. I've got people coming in from Rhode Island. I've got Harvard people coming in. And I'm going to start with that statement. I'm going to start with the statement about how I felt so frustrated because there wasn't this reservoir of people that I could turn to, given the nature of what's happening to the media and the consolidation. So thank you so much for sticking it out. Thank you so much for having this institutional memory. I really value it. So let me remind everyone that we taped the show on Thursday morning. It'll air on Friday. But as we were pulling Kevin onto the air, Kevin was actually watching the New Hampshire legislature vote on minimum wage. Now, let me start with a little bit back here. History. New Hampshire does not have a state minimum wage. Let me repeat that.
Right.
We do not have one. That means that we rely on whatever the feds have done. The feds have not changed the minimum wage from $7.25 for decades. So as a result, and if the feds decided, for example, to get rid of their minimum wage, we would not have one because we don't have one in place. So the real question is, we have a Democratic legislature. We have a Republican governor who obviously is running for election in 2020, as all the members of the legislature are. And there has been a big push with these Democrats to actually introduce not only a minimum wage, but a livable wage. So tell me what happened in the committee and what just happened on the floor of the New Hampshire House, because to a large extent, the conversation we're hearing about the minimum wage and a livable wage is one we're also hearing being played out in the 2020 campaign.
Sure. Well, the House committee spent the summer and fall trying to work out a minimum wage bill that they hoped could get bipartisan support, but did not, and we'll talk about that. They ended up with a proposal over three steps that would raise the minimum wage to $10 right away and then up to $13 an hour by 2024. Mm-hmm. Now, as you pointed out, New Hampshire not only doesn't have a minimum wage, we're the only state in New England that has, because we default to the federal $7.25, no other state in New England has a minimum lower than $10 an hour, right? So we really, because of the trajectory of states increasing their minimum wages over time, we keep falling farther and farther and farther behind.
Right.
And certainly supporters of this proposal basically say that, as we know, we have a national economy that's doing reasonably well. We have an incredibly low unemployment rate here in New Hampshire, one of the lowest in the country. We have a workforce problem in New Hampshire. Our problem is finding workers for the jobs that are available.
So
one way for employers to attract employees to New Hampshire would be to offer higher wages, would be to offer better benefits. So this, in the minds of the supporters, this is the perfect time to raise the minimum wage when actually employers, it might incentivize people to come to New Hampshire to find jobs here. But what we saw, which was interesting on the floor of the House on Thursday, was a membership a progressive membership of the House, a more liberal membership of the House, wanting to go further than what the committee wanted to go for. So they supported what the committee had recommended, but they then upped the ante, meaning they then offered their own amendment that would raise it to $15 an hour,
right,
over five steps.
Right.
And that passed by 20 votes, 189 to 177. And then finally the bill passed by an even larger margin, about 50 or 60 votes. We've had Governor Chris Sununu has been solidly with the National Federation of Independent Businesses and other organizations that oppose raising the minimum wage,
right,
not because they don't want to pay employees $10 an hour. They feel that
the market
should set the rates, and they also feel that if you set a bar that high, then in order to attract employees, you have to offer them even higher wages than that. The other thing that these organizations say, and the governor has said as well, is that if you set too high a minimum wage, that employers will look for ways to get the job done other than full-time employment.
Mm-hmm.
They'll look at more automation, mm-hmm, as Andrew Yang has talked about in Democratic presidential campaign.
Right.
They'll look at more outsourcing, mm-hmm, and not having people work for them as full-time waged employees, but rather pay independent contractors.
Right.
They can pay under the minimum wage.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the reasons why folks oppose it.
So let me ask a quick question. Was it bipartisan, the vote, or was it strictly down partisan lines, the increase to $15?
Yeah, it was pretty much down partisan lines.
Right. Okay.
We haven't seen much evidence. There were no Republican speakers who got up and spoke for it.
Mm-hmm.
And the Republican platform has opposed the minimum wage, and this governor has opposed the minimum wage. And as we saw with the fight over more than 50 vetoes last year, they're a cohesive minority. These Republicans in the New Hampshire legislature, they stick together and they follow this governor's lead. And I suspect they're going to do that in spades in this election year session.
Well, you know, the interesting thing, I want to remind everyone that New Hampshire is one of the richest states in the nation. It's also one of the most expensive states in the nation. People are waxing poetic about the fact that they can't find housing because there's nothing in the way of affordable housing. And when you have a minimum wage of $7.25, you're living in the street. So let me, I just want people to sort of translate this. So part of the rationale for
fourth highest average median income in New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Lowest child poverty rate in the nation, in New Hampshire.
Right.
And that's why people who support raising the minimum wage say it doesn't, this is not a good look for New Hampshire. As we continue trying to improve this economy, we're not sending the right message for people to come to the state. Again, look at where New Hampshire is. Unlike most New England states, we had last year, we were one of the only 10 states in the country. Well, more people died than people were born in New Hampshire last year. But the good news was we had more migration.
Right.
I mean, we're a state that's one-sixth the size of Massachusetts. We had 70% as many people come to this state than came to Massachusetts.
Right.
I mean, so we are attractive in that way. And so raising the minimum wage is another way to increase that appeal
for people to
New Hampshire.
Right, and let me just say something else. And the other reason why it's attractive is that when you look at the kind of student debt we have, the highest student debt in the country, when you look at the tuition costs in the country, students used to be able to work to pay off some of their tuition during the summer, during the whatever. And yet, because of the kind of wages we have, what you're finding out is you're actually incurring more student debt because you're not able to earn enough to make anything of consequence to help you pay for college. So in a way, you have to look at the whole picture. The gestalt. You want young people to stay. You want to address the student debt. You want people to work, but work at what wage? You want people to move out of the house because it's good for the real estate market, but how do you move out of the house when the wages you're earning are not significant, especially at the very beginning of your career? So I think it's going to be a very interesting. And plus, this is the story. This sort of wage gap, the income gap, is also a story you're going to hear at the national level.
Yeah.
Another interesting thing. So we know that Sununu is going to basically, you know, hug Donald Trump, hug the Republican Party. He's going to veto a livable wage. That will be interesting to see how that plays out, especially in places like the North Country, which are historically places where Republicans do well, but they're also the poorest places, the places where they basically are working at the minimum wage. So for them, this would be the biggest wage increase they've ever seen, given the fact that they've never seen anything in the way of significant investment. So this is an investment in a place that both votes historically Republican, but they would actually benefit more than any other part of the state in the North Country. Now let's go to the red flag law. Big issue for both Republicans and Democrats in the 2020 campaign is the whole issue of guns. Explain to us what happened in the New Hampshire legislature, what the red flag law is, and the fact that that Governor Sununu is threatening to veto that bill. That, to me, seems to be so extreme when you realize that the vast majority of people would easily support that. And I'm just trying to figure out how much money is he going to get from the NRA that's worth it, because that's really what I think the cost-benefit analysis is here.
Yeah, the there are 17 states in the District of Columbia that have these red flag laws. It's referred to as an extreme risk protection order.
Right.
And what we have here essentially is a family member or intimate partner or law enforcement, if they see someone who possesses a firearm who they believe is a danger to themselves or to others, can ask a judge to temporarily seize those firearms until the point at which that person has stabilized and the firearms can be returned to them.
Right.
The New Hampshire House this week passed that bill, but not with bipartisan support, as we talked about with minimum wage. I mean, almost all the Republicans were against it. About almost two dozen Democrats in the House voted against that bill. And why is that? Because all the gun groups opposed it, all of them. And they all saw it as gun confiscation. One of the kind of wrinkles here we should talk about is there's the National Crime Database, okay? And so once guns are taken away from you, you get put on the National Crime Database. And the gun groups essentially say, okay, this is a temporary measure, they can have it back. But New Hampshire does have no protocol for how you get off the National Crime Database once your name gets on the National Crime Database. And the federal law is clear, meaning the federal law says to the states, you've got to set up your own protocol, but we don't let your people off that database. And New Hampshire's never done that because New Hampshire doesn't support that program, right? And
right.
And hasn't voluntarily cooperated with that program. That's one of the reasons why all the gun groups had opposed this.
Okay, so the governor says
there's no reason to change our gun laws. We're one of the safest states in the nation. This is a problem in search of a solution.
Okay, so let me just ask a question. If that's true, that there isn't a way to get off this registry, then why wasn't that included in the legislation? If you don't want to make this a permanent stigma, if you want to say that the operative word here, Kevin Landrigan, is temporary, this would seem to undermine their argument of temporary if you can't get off this list. So why didn't they include that? Is there because there's a cost of setting something up to get you off?
No, it really wasn't that. It's really that, you know, like we've talked about, you know, what we have here is, you know, meatloaf, right? Legislative meatloaf. And by that, I mean this is left over from the 2019 session. It's been worked on, but many of these bills often aren't fully formed, you know? And you spend this next year, once a bill like this moves through the process, fully forming that bill. That's why I suspect now it's left the House. I fully expect the Democratic majority in the state Senate to work on that.
Attack
that. One of the things, for example, this committee did do during the summer and fall that wasn't in the original flag bill was it dealt with false accusations. And what do I mean by that? Well, what's the consequence for saying, hey, my boyfriend's dangerous, take his guns away, and you're lying. Your boyfriend isn't dangerous.
Right, you're being a jerk.
They shouldn't have been taken away in the first place.
Right.
And this bill allows the judge to do it by telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's the whole due process argument that the gun groups were making. Well, this committee did include in the bill that they had reworked to a certain degree, a criminal penalty someone who makes a false accusation,
wow, okay,
making it a criminal misdemeanor,
right,
subject to jail of up to 1 year.
Wow.
If you make an accusation like that, that proves to be without foundation.
Yeah.
So,
in answer to your point,
this issue of a state protocol to getting off the federal list, I think we'll spend a couple of months now working on that and trying to perfect that. But I should amend something you had said about Sununu hugging Trump. Sununu's respecting Trump. But Sununu is marketing himself as separate from Trump. I can give you several indications.
Well, please do that. Please do that.
A lot of this, like I say, branding, not substance.
Okay.
He came out with a clean energy bill this week, a clean energy package to say, I'm not just for fossil fuels, I'm for renewables. Now, the Democrats say, this is small change, this isn't systemic change.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, like I said, it's all about marketing. He's come out, he vetoed a bill dealing with vulnerable adults and what you do with vulnerable adults. And that bill would have included having a protection order that could include taking the guns away. And so he's worked out a Republican alternative,
mm-hmm,
to protect vulnerable adults that allows for protective orders but doesn't allow for confiscation of firearms. Family and medical leave. He's against a mandatory family and medical leave program.
Right.
But he's proposed a voluntary program, which would offer businesses a tax credit if they actually provide their employees with family leave. Like I said, so much of this is branding, marketing, symbolism versus substance.
Right.
But it's not hugging Trump. It's doing quite the opposite. I mean, let me ask you a question.
Is he quite aware if he's
too close to Trump, he could become a governor who doesn't get a third term.
Well,
next November.
Right. And it's going to be so interesting to see how this whole thing plays out, because
right,
in part what we're seeing is the Democrats are offering up legislation that basically they know Sununu will veto. And yet the legislation they know Sununu will veto will make him even more attached to Donald Trump, because the raison d'etre for a lot of the vetoes are basically it sort of fits into the sort of the Trump agenda. So,
yes,
he's trying to back away saying, oh, look at me with clean energy.
Yeah.
Big deal. As everyone says, it is a drop in the bucket. But then what the Democrats are doing, which is so interesting, is that they are not necessarily setting things up to ultimately get passed, i.e. he signs it into law, but to actually point out how extreme Chris Sununu is, and that his extreme that we saw with the 50 vetoes he did in the last session. By the way, everyone, Governor Sununu vetoed 50 bills, more than any governor in history. So that creates 50 groups that absolutely hate his guts because of what he vetoed. And now what the Democrats are doing are very interesting. They're basically sort of laying out what will be heard from the Democratic candidate running for president in 2020. They're also exposing Chris Sununu to some kind of a liability because the things he'll veto just make him even more attached to Donald Trump. It's going to be such an interesting year. And then I want to remind everyone, because this is the state of New Hampshire, I got a call the other day from one of the national news medias about Corey Lewandowski. And let me remind everyone, we also have a big and important U.S. Senate race. Jeanne Shaheen is running for the United States Senate for, I believe, a third term. And and Jeanne Shaheen historically has been very sort of liked. She's gotten lots of votes. She's almost the Teflon candidate. But for a while there, we thought that Corey Lewandowski, who ran Donald Trump's campaign, who is from Windham, New Hampshire, was going to run against her. And, I know, I was on C-SPAN. So they asked me about Corey, and I said Corey was the gift that kept on giving. And I said the reason why Corey's threat to run against Jeanne Shaheen for the United States Senate was a gift was that Jeanne Shaheen raised thousands and thousands of dollars across the United States saying, Corey Lewandowski may run against me, knowing full well that Corey Lewandowski was probably never going to run against her. Because as I said, Corey Lewandowski likes to make money. He doesn't want to raise money for a campaign. And this was good for him because it sort of gave him some national cred, but we knew he was going to be pulling out. So tell me a little bit about how the U.S. Senate race is going to impact what we're seeing happening in New Hampshire. I don't see a strong candidate running against her on the Republican ticket, but I do see that it makes Chris Sununu even more vulnerable.
Yeah. What's interesting about that race, right, is now that Lewandowski is out, you know, on one level, that's bad news for Gene Shaheen. You know, you don't have a foil like that,
exactly,
as you point out, to raise money across the country. And also to increase anxiety, which in elections, right, that's what people often don't understand. I mean,
yep,
is that you want to increase anxiety as a candidate and a campaign,
yep,
because that motivates your voters and your supporters to give more money, to do more volunteer hours, to,
right,
you know, to really get worked up. Now the fear is, you know, in the Shaheen camp, of course, is, oh, she's got no problem, everything's going to be fine.
It's a cakewalk.
There's not, I mean, there aren't a lot of vulnerable Democrats in the U.S. Senate in 2020. Her
exactly
seat is one of the more competitive ones. And what's really interesting right now is former House Speaker Bill O'Brien, movement conservative, the guy who actually took away the state minimum wage when he was Speaker of the House, right?
Yeah.
He's a national, not popular figure in conservative circles, okay? But in Washington, there are a lot of folks in Washington who don't think he's electable and think he has too much baggage.
I think you're right.
What's really interesting about that primary is the other two candidates who are now in the race, retired Brigadier General Don Voldick from Stratum, Afghanistan war hero, mm-hmm, Corky Messner from Wolfboro, Denver, Colorado, trial lawyer who made a fortune as a trial lawyer representing corporations. You're seeing what's really interesting in the race. You're seeing Bolduc and Messner go all over the state and basically parroting O'Brien on positions. O'Brien,
wow,
talks about, I'm against abortion for all purposes. They all say, us too, we are too. You know, they talk about whatever it is, pick the issue. Education reform. International trade.
So you get the themes with none of the liability.
Right.
Exactly.
And so both of them are auditioning to be the more electable, you know, version of Bill O'Brien. I've got all these positions, but look at me. And this is the thing. This is, like I said, in politics, you always want, when you're running against a candidate, you always want a playbook, right?
Right.
Of your opponent. And that's the problem Shaheen has with either Messner and Bolduc. Neither one has held elective office.
Right.
Neither one has a voting record.
Right.
So in this primary, they can appear as conservative as Bill O'Brien in order to get the support in the primary.
And then move.
And then if they win the nomination, they can move to the middle.
Wow.
And they can say, I'm more moderate than that. I'm not Bill O'Brien.
So let me just ask a question, because Republican primaries, which we have a late primary in New Hampshire, everyone, while we may have that, we have a February.
One of the latest in the country.
Right.
Yes.
We have a February primary for the presidential candidates, but we have a September primary for the state candidates. And of course, this is also going to impact what happens in 2020. The one problem I see having with those two candidates that you were just describing that were not Bill O'Brien is that they will divide the sort of the more rational Republican that shows up in the primary. But primaries,
right,
are historically places where the most extreme come. They want to participate. They have a reason for participating. And if anything, Bill O'Brien has cultivated that extreme group. They know him. His,
sure,
name is familiar. He was a Speaker of the House. These other two guys, they feel, you
he's
know,
also,
I mean,
he's also got Ted Cruz supporting his campaign.
There you go.
So, I mean,
that's
a popular movement conservative,
right,
down there.
Right.
So I worry
that while Washington may be unhappy about Bill O'Brien running because I think it sets it up for Gene Shaheen, I think what they have is the other two are sort of dividing what's left of the non-Bill,
yeah,
O'Brien vote. That only bodes well for Bill O'Brien because because you don't have to think about him. His name, because he's so notorious in New Hampshire, he's notorious because Democrats hate him, but Republicans, for the most part, not so much. You know, they actually kind of admire him. So it's going to be fascinating. And I wish the other two guys luck, but I'm not sure that they're going to be successful in this campaign. Last but not least,
okay,
if Iowa obviously has its caucus and things yes. change in Iowa. Someone asked me a question, like Cory Booker, he's, you know, this is, seems like his last hurrah. He's putting in a yeah. lot of work and effort into Iowa. Let's say yeah. Cory Booker comes in fourth in Iowa. I don't think it'll happen, but let's just say it yeah. could. Right now, I think it's, it would be maybe Klobuchar at this point. But let's say it's Cory. Would that change how people look at Cory coming into New Hampshire?
You know, it's a lot of people. You were talking about the dean. That means I'm very old. This is my yeah. 10th presidential primary.
I know.
And in every presidential primary, I've heard this. Can somebody make a back of the rush move near but not to
right.
the front
right.
in Iowa and get attention in New Hampshire? This will be the first one if it happens. I don't think it does happen. I really don't.
Okay.
I mean, I do think in this, what is unique about this race is the reverse. Meaning, I think Iowa and New Hampshire, there is a similarity this year, and that is people are really having trouble making a choice here.
They are totally.
And they're having trouble making a choice
completely.
In Iowa.
Completely.
And so what happens in Iowa will matter, and I think it will influence New Hampshire,
yep.
but it has to be someone in the top three in Iowa.
So let me,
meaning if you get that far, like if Klobuchar were to get 2/3,
right.
you know, then she's got a chance of staging a Kasich charge. Like charge in New Hampshire.
All right, later. I need to let you go,
but
Kevin.
It's got to be that high.
I hear you.
If you're not getting one of these ribbons in Iowa, even if you outperformed expectations, I don't think enough. It's going to move enough. Of the needle here in New Hampshire.
All right, Kevin Landrigan is the dean of the Concord, New Hampshire Press Corps. We're doing Dean Squared today with Scott Braddock and Kevin Landrigan. Thank you so much. We have to stay in touch because things are going to get wilder and wilder as the primary approaches. Thank you so much, Kevin.
Thanks for having me, Arnie.
You're welcome. Kevin Landrigan writes for the Union Leader. This is the Friday edition of The Attitude. See you next week. You change.